Sounds like you're ready for tomorrow. Wonderful, wonderful. It looks like the revolution is alive and well and will continue. Thank you very much for inviting me to this little revolution there. First of all, I want to make sure that the ladies that did work so hard to put this together, Ruth and Deb and Sharon, get a proper applause along with Debbie Hopper. They really worked hard to put this together. But it is a real delight to be here, and frequently I remark that when I give speeches in Washington, they never get the reception I get when I leave Washington. But we're going to change all that. We're going to change that where we're going to take this philosophy that we hold dear and make sure it is reflected in Washington, D.C., in each and every single capital of all our states in this country. Yeah. You know, something big has happened this last year. A lot of times we talk about governments doing dumb things and having the unintended consequences of sometimes well-intentioned activities. But you know, I think in this campaign, there has been a lot of good unintentioned consequences, things that I never dreamed of. I never dreamed that we could energize so many people. And a lot of people give me credit for that, and I'm very reluctant to take it. I know I participate in it. But believe me, what has really energized this country has been the opportunity for us as a group to offer a message which is truly American and truly defends the principles of liberty. Over these several years before I opened up an exploratory committee, quite a few individuals, maybe quite a few even in this audience, would write me and say, please run and please run. And my answer was, no, I don't intend to, because I think we're not ready yet. I knew exactly where we were. I've been in politics since the 70s, in and out, but always engaged, always seeking one goal. And I still didn't believe the country would respond in a favorable enough manner where we could get enough people and be credible. To my amazement and to my surprise, there were a lot more of you out there than I ever dreamed of. Say have been in the remnant and knew about it and were waiting for a time, but we have also had an unbelievable reception by the young people in this country who say, this sounds like the right program for us. And a few other things came into place. One is that the failure of the system has become readily apparent. That's sad, but it is. It's more apparent than ever before. And even compared to 16 months ago when I first filed the exploratory committee, it's more apparent than ever, the failure of government. This means that people are asking questions. Back 16 months ago, maybe half the country would say, yeah, we're probably going on the wrong course. Today, 90% of the American people claim that we're on the wrong course and that we have to change our course, which means that they have to look for different answers. And quite frankly, they have not heard any of the answers coming from any of the other candidates. And then there's this other secret that is no longer a secret. The cat has been let out of the bag. And they've tried to make fun of this little secret weapon, the political equalizer called the Internet. You know, I think it was after the first debate, I didn't feel like I did anything exceptional other than do my best to tell the truth, and I guess that was exceptional. Surprised, and they said, you know, you're winning the post-debate polling. Well, that sounds pretty good. But then later on, I was listening to the news, But then I thought, oh, I guess it doesn't make much sense. But they made fun. They said, oh, that's those 36 spammers Ron Paul has up there. That's how to fudge the poll. But the question is, if it was so easy to spam and to fudge the poll, why weren't any other ones smart enough to do it either? But then when we started having our rallies, the rallies kept getting bigger and more enthusiastic, and the money came in, and the supporters were there, and it finally dawned on everybody, there's more than 36 of you out there. Not only 36 spammers, we have not thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but we now have captured well over 1 million people who have committed to voting in our primary. Become convinced of is that for the 1 million+ that have voted in the Republican primary, and that's not exactly the most enthusiastic place in the world today in a primary that is sort of shrinking in size, and sometimes when we want to help and build the primary, sometimes they don't have an open door policy in receiving us in there. But as I travel and visit and talk to so many people at airports, I find out that, you know, that 1 million that has made his commitment in our Republican primary is probably just a small portion of the people that support what we're doing. I mean, there's a lot of people who might have even voted in the other primary, might not have voted at all, might not have ever considered voting in a Republican primary. Philosophically, they're very interested, and they know darn well that we're on the right track, and the support is not 1 million, but many millions more who are receiving this message. So the conditions just turned out to be right. The country's in trouble. Proof and the obvious evidence that things aren't working right. At the same time, a message is being spread like it has never spread before, is coming together, and this is why there has been so much enthusiasm. And this to me is really a great compliment, and I am very pleased with this, but I am absolutely convinced it is the message. I have an ability and a chance to present our case, and I do my very best, but I'll tell you one thing that I have no doubts about. There's no doubts in my mind that the message of liberty is what this country needs. Yeah. In the 1960s, I studied Austrian free market economics, got involved with Hayek and Mises and others, and there were predictions made that came about in 1971 about the breakdown of our monetary system. And of course, since then, we've been limping along. But that motivated me to get involved in politics because I thought at that time we were on the wrong track. I still think we're on the wrong track. But at least it got me energized to run for office and win. First time I won was in 1976. But this recent time to get involved in this campaign, I remain interested in economics. Very, very crucial. The overriding issue, of course, is personal liberty and what America stands for. But in specifics, it was the war issue that made me make this decision a year and a half ago to do what I can. Because I did come to the conclusion, after many, many years of working hard to try to prevent that war from coming, in 1998, there was a resolution I said would lead to war, long time before 9/11. And it was this great danger that this country has embarked on in going to war needlessly and carelessly. And we've been doing this not just under this episode, but we've been doing it since World War II. And we get into this trouble because we don't follow the law of the land. The law of the land is the Constitution. It says we should never go to war unless there's a declaration of war, and then go in and fight it, win it, and get a medal. this is important for several reasons. One, we ought to obey the law, which is the Constitution. The other is that when you fight wars that aren't fought in defense, they're immoral, because we weren't being threatened by these third world nations that we have attacked. And also, it's so dangerous, and people die, our people die, and their people die, and it's just terrible. And also, there's these economic consequences of the war. So all these reasons add up that it makes no sense whatsoever. But what they like to do is trap us into saying, well, if you don't support the war, you don't support the troops. And you don't, so you're not American, you're not patriotic. And I say that is completely wrong. You can be pro-American, you can be patriotic, you can be conservative, and you're a constitutionalist, not to go to war carelessly. Resolutions, which on the surface and the title would always be support the troops. And if you didn't support, you vote for it, then you were not supportive of the troops. But always at the bottom of the resolution, it was you supported the policy. You endorsed all the things that they're doing for the wrong reason. And the whole idea was if you didn't do it, then you were painted, you know, as being not patriotic. But one thing that has happened, pleasantly so, and to slightly to my surprise, but when you think about it, it shouldn't surprise us. But if you take all the donations of all the military personnel over the last year or so, and you take all the candidates, our campaign got more money from the military personnel than everybody else put together. Should send a very strong message to everyone that our position is the correct position, and is something that we have to take care of. Economically, though, it's foolhardy, but also it's foolhardy in times of war. We're expected to do one more thing. In a time of war, it's critical, and we're supposed to give up our liberties and for the sake of the war. But whether it's the war against terrorism or war against some foreign element, there is never a need to give up personal liberty for the sake of security. We now have a war against terrorism. Terrorism happens to be a tactic. You can't declare war against terrorism. But the nature of this means that it's going to be long-lasting. The enemy is invisible. They're every place. And that means the Army and the Navy and the Air Force can be every place around the world and spend endlessly. And we're expected to sit back and have our liberties undermined constantly. And think about what has happened since 9/11. How much erosion of our liberties have occurred? And what are they doing now to us? And the Congress passed this, and we have to stop it. And that is the national ID card. We need to get that stopped. But systematically, since 9/11, we've had so many bills passed. We had very quickly after the 9/11, we had the Patriot Act. But the solution to that is rather simple. That allows warrantless searches, no respect for the Fourth Amendment, and does nothing to make us safer. It makes us less free, is what it does. So the position that all politicians should have right now is the repeal of the Patriot Act. We don't need secret courts and secret prisons. We don't need torture. And we do need to once again restore the absolute integrity of habeas corpus. But we do live in very dangerous times. Threats to our liberties, a war that is spreading, perpetual war. At the same time, we're facing an economic crisis. We faced an economic crisis in the early 1970s when I got interested in what was happening in the economy and the breakdown of the Bretton Woods Agreement. And we had a bad time in the 70s. But back then, we survived it rather well, even though it was a bad decade. It was a lot of payback for the guns and butter of the 1960s. It nevertheless was a reflection of a failed policy. And yet we're doing the same thing again. The guns and butter is what we're paying for once again. But in the 1970s, we had no foreign debt. We were a creditor nation. We had a still manufacturing job. Today, our manufacturing jobs have gone overseas. We're a debtor nation. We owe $13 trillion to foreigners. The young people of this country are inheriting an entitlement obligation of $60 trillion. We have a national debt nearing $10 trillion. And yet, on the surface, we still seem to be doing pretty well. But for some reason or other, and the people are wise, better than the government statistics tell us, the people are saying that 90% are unhappy with the direction of the country because they know that there's something seriously flawed and that their standard of living is going down. It's a reflection of a flawed monetary system, a flawed economic system, a spending system, a political system, and a deeply flawed foreign policy that has to be changed. If we ever want to restore true integrity, most of those programs should go, if not all of them. At the same time, though, you don't try to solve the problems by saying cutting child health care, cutting veterans benefits, cutting aid to the elderly. You don't have to do that. This country still has a lot of wealth, and the government still has way too much money. The problem is the way they spend the money is where we're running into trouble. If we wanted to have and to provide a transitory period, what we need to do, change foreign policy. We're spending $1 trillion to maintain our empire around the world. We have 700 bases overseas in 130 countries. We have less friends than ever before, more enemies than ever before. The morale of the military is lower than ever. At the same time, there are more suicides occurring in the military, and we're less defended. What are we doing now? We're closing bases down in this country and building bases up in Iraq, just antagonizing people. Should be the other way around. Tear down the bases overseas and put the bases here at home. That were incapable of attacking us. They couldn't commit aggression against us. But we have spent billions of dollars. Just think, even before the current war going on, during the 90s, we were constantly bombing, you know, Iraq. As bad as he wasn't a threat to us. But what do? We pay to blow up their bridges and their infrastructure, and then we feel bad about it, and then we go back to the taxpayer, and we tax it, the taxpayers get taxed again to rebuild the bridges and the infrastructure. I would say, do neither, but take care of the infrastructure here in this country. Our bridges here at home. We, we could save a lot of money. This $1 trillion we spend overseas, you could save hundreds of billions of dollars if you change policy. And it isn't so strange. It's the policy that the founders advised. Matter of fact, it was the policy of the Republican Party not too many years ago. You know, especially the old right had this position, the Robert Taft position. But as recent as the year 2000, our party gained control of the House and the Senate and the presidency on a foreign policy that said we were tired of nation building and policing the world by Bill Clinton. So look, we won on that position, and look at what we've done. Look at what we've done to the budget. And it was a time when we used to want to get rid of the Department of Education, the Department of Energy. We finally get in charge, and we double the size of the Department of Energy. I like the old days when we said, get rid of the Department of Education and the Department of Energy. And then they wonder why the party is shrinking. And the one what I wonder about is why the doors aren't wide open to the supporters of the Constitution and limited government and liberty. But we did cut back. We can cut back enough to balance the budget, pace down some deficit. I think it would improve the price of oil overnight. It would improve the value of the dollar because the sign would be that we're getting our house in order. And then we don't have to cut people who are totally dependent. You could have a transition. You could work it out where you could cut so much that you could actually offer the next generation, offer the young people, the opportunity of enjoying liberty. That is, assuming responsibility for themselves and let them get out of Social Security and take care of themselves. Well, this is heartless. There's no compassion. You know what is what lacks compassion? If you continue to do what we're doing, because we're destroying the money, we're destroying the budget, we're destroying our liberties, we're exposing ourselves around the world, and just printing money won't help. I mean, the elderly will need more help. Their standard of living is going down. Inflation is over 10%. Our government says it's 2%, and they can't keep up. And the only way they will even try to keep up is just printing more money. And when the confidence is lost in the dollar, which is being lost on a daily basis, that means that everybody is going to get hurt. So that is the system that I think lacks compassion. Freedom is the only thing that offers true compassion and a true way of producing enough goods and services to take care of the maximum number of people. One thing that we haven't done very well, and it is a responsibility of the federal government, well, there's a couple. They do mostly the things they're not supposed to do and ignore the important thing. But one that I've talked about so much has been the issue of money. Now, it is in the Constitution. The government has a role to play. Even though I happen to believe that if you had true freedom, freedom could deal with money. And it would be natural money, and it would be metal, and you'd have to make sure that nobody committed fraud. But it was given the responsibility of the federal government to devise a currency. And they were very particular about it because they had runaway inflation with the continental dollar. So they said there would be no bills of credit, no paper money, and only gold and silver could be legal tender. And one... put in the Constitution, and that was the authority for a central bank. So under those conditions, there would be no Federal Reserve System, and we should work to get rid of the Federal Reserve System.
No!
probably the most pleasant surprise I've had when it comes to issue is the fact that so many are responding to the issue of money because they tell you all the time, over and over, especially in Washington, oh, it's too complex, the people can't understand money. I said, yeah, like if you print a lot of money, it doesn't lose its value. That's really complex. But it is very sinister. You know, Hamilton and Jefferson argued about it, and Jackson didn't like a central bank, and he got rid of it. And we will get rid of this one. If we don't get rid of it in a deliberate fashion, we'll get rid of it because it's going to self-destruct because it can't continue. But if the central bank and inflation serves the interests of powerful special interests. Whether you're in the military-industrial complex or the banking industry or the medical industry or the media or whatever, those who get to use the money first benefit the most. And this is why it is so popular. And, of course, the politicians do quite well with inflation because, yes, they tax to a degree, but there has to be a limit because if they tax 98%, nobody would work or there would be a real revolution. And then also the borrowing, there's limits on borrowing. But you can pass the bill off for a while to an invisible generation. Put it off a couple years into people who don't know they're really getting stuck with the bill. And that encourages governments to grow and spend and not be responsible. And that is why I think it is so bad that individuals can get away with inflation. Inflation really is a tax. Conservatives frequently argue that, only the wealthy pay taxes. The poor people, they don't even have to pay income tax. Of course, they pay the regressive Social Security tax, which is to me an income tax. But what they're trying to say is those individuals who don't pay income tax don't really pay a tax, which is not right. Because the real tax is how painful it is when you go to the gas pump and pay $4 a gallon. How painful is it when you have to go to the doctors or buy some medication for your kids? And in those areas, the prices are skyrocketing. And that is a tax because the value of the money goes down. And this is the way the bills are paid, and they are the victims, and they think they're invisible. But the country is waking up. They're understanding the money issue, and they realize that it doesn't make any sense just to print more money. Now, what have we been doing these last 2 or 3 years since the banking, the crisis has been developing, and there's a crisis on Wall Street? Everything is bailout. Of course, they have to bail out the mortgage companies, not $10 billion, hundreds of billions of dollars. And a company like Bear Stearns, $50 billion. The housing market. Then, of course, they want to try to bail out all the homeowners for political reasons. But how do they do this? Do they have any money up there? There's no money up there. They just create it. Now, what about this whole idea that, looks like we don't want a recession, so if the people only had a couple more dollars in their pocket, they might feel better and not think they're in a recession. So they send you either $600 or $1,200, and that might not even buy you a tank of gas for very long. I imagine that money, during that period of time when they first decided it, and by the time the money came and was spent, it was probably spent on the increase in the cost of gasoline. It didn't help at all. But they did this just by printing money. It's all only gimmicks. And I think the people are on to this, and they know it's not going to work. We've got to get this thing under control. And it's out of control for one particular reason. And that is we have no respect for the rule of law. We don't have enough respect for the Constitution. If we did, we wouldn't be in this mess, and that's how we get out of the mess. Last year, as I found out that freedom truly is popular. Believe me, it is. And freedom does work. Freedom works because it brings people together. Because it doesn't tell people what they ought to do with their lives. Oh yeah, it's risky business. Just think, your lives will be turned over to you and you won't have the guidance of the government to tell you what to do with your life. And lo and behold, you might do something silly or dumb, and you might do something unwise, and you might not eat the right food, and you might even smoke the wrong stuff. And it's only government that can take care of it. But just think, generally speaking, we trust ourselves to decide what books we're going to read intellectually, intellectual curiosity. That's supposed to be up to us to decide, and that's pretty important. Economic philosophy, boy, that's big stuff. If you accept the wrong ideas, you can destroy a country. Then we still allow freedom of choice. We allow freedom of choice in our religious values, and there we're treating with our eternal souls. But when it comes to our bodies, we turn around and we say, oh my, the government has to tell us what we can eat and what we can drink because we can't trust ourselves. We can't trust our parents. We can't trust our own judgment because we might want to make a mistake. But the real harm from that, some of them do this with good intentions, but you know by good intentions, sometimes it can lead down to you know where. But this whole idea that the government has this control over us means that the government then will use that same force to, say, control all our nutrition, all our vitamins, all our alternative medicine. Whether or not you even have the right to drink unpasteurized milk, the government wants to tell you that, whether you can do this or not. I mean, that is the nanny state. That is the opposite of liberty. It doesn't work. It degrades us. It humiliates us. And we have to have faith and trust and understanding that freedom really works and that we can trust ourselves. Does that mean it will be a perfect world? No, it won't. Some people are going to mess up. But if you have your freedom to spend your money as you see fit, if you have your freedom to make your own personal choices and you mess up, the one thing that goes along with it is you don't have a right to go to your neighbor by sending the government agent with a gun, collecting money, and say, you're going to take care of me now because I messed up. You can't do that. That is one of the things that we do so carelessly. We grant to the government powers that they do not deserve. Power to tell us what to do with our lives. Power over our money. The whole principle of the income tax is absolutely wrong. Principle that the government owns all our income, which means they own our life and they own the fruits of our labor. So they take the money and then they allow us to keep a certain percentage under certain conditions and all the rules. You get some back if you do this, A, B, and C, and D. And this is, you know, so destructive. So what we want is the right to our life, because our life and our liberties don't come from our government. Our life and liberties come to us in a natural way. For me, they come to us from our Creator, and they belong to us, not to the government. Deserves protection under the law. But if the government assumes this responsibility and control over the fruits of our labor, then of course they have this tax system. So the solution is, for us, is to repeal the 16th Amendment and make sure that we don't have a personal income tax. Question that I usually get from the media is, well, how are you going to finance the government? What are you going to replace it with? Is it going to be a flat tax? Is it going to be a sales tax, a user fee? What are you going to do? What are you going to replace it with? I say replace it with nothing! But if you replace it without cutting, it's going to be a mess. I'd still vote for it, though. But if you need to cut the spending, of course, I said the easiest place to cut the spending is overseas. But if we didn't have an income tax today, we'd still have as much revenues in Washington, D.C. as we had 10 years ago. Don't you think our government was plenty big 10 years ago? We didn't need that much government then. So we don't need it. What we need is a change in attitude. We need a change in philosophy. That's what this campaign is all about, an attitude and what the philosophy of government ought to be. The main question that all of us have to ask, especially our young people, is what should the role of government be? The founders basically asked that question at the time of the revolution. They did not like the role of government of the king, and they wanted the change. And they were well-versed, they were well-educated, and they knew exactly what the role of government ought to be, and that was to protect liberty, not to manage our lives, not to run the economy, and not to police the world. A good president, which if it ever came to that point where I would be the president, description would obviously change. But the goal would be the preservation of liberty, because I have such confidence that free people know what to do with their lives and they can make so much more sense of it. Now, we've had a grand experiment in this country, and it's worked well, but not so well in these last several decades. Frequently, and I'm sure many of you have been accused of this, is once you defend our position, you say, "Oh, you guys want to go back to the dark ages? You want to go back to the gold standard? You want to go back? You want to go back? You want to go back to the Bill of Rights? You want to go back to the Ten Commandments? And you want to do all these wonderful things?" So they say this is ancient. I'll tell you what is ancient in the history of mankind: tyranny. Tyranny is ancient. And what we're getting is more tyranny on a daily basis, and we have a military state that is out of control, and what we want to do is restore those principles of our original revolution. So this is something that is modern and new. The experiment had worked, and we have now drifted from it. We've about rejected it. We don't have the respect that we need and the understanding for liberty. And this is a real test, because it can get pretty dangerous. It can get dangerous militarily. It can get dangerous economically. And what happens if you do have a true dollar crisis, runaway inflation, and the system breaks down? I mean, it is not, if you look at all the history, it doesn't go well. And then sometimes you end up with more government instead of less. And of course, my goal is to actually offer a program where you can work your way back. But if we can't work our way back and we end up with a crisis, what we need, and this is where I'm most encouraged this year, is that there are still so many people who will receive this message, and so many Americans who know about this message. We're much better off than the Soviets were. Their system failed not because we had to fight them in the nuclear war. Their system failed for economic reasons. They couldn't afford to keep the system going. They went broke. They went broke because their military machine was spread too wide around the world, and it collapsed. In our case, we do have good traditions. We once knew what sound money meant. We know what property rights means. We know what contract rights mean. Of course, we're not doing a very good job today. Today, what happens is we're threatened by eminent domain, and they tell us that we still own our land. Do you believe you own your land? When all you have to do is pay rent and ask the government to use it and fill out forms. If you don't, you know, they either arrest you for misusing the land, or they take your land because you didn't pay your taxes on time. We want to own our land in a free society. We essentially know how the election will come out in the Republican primary. The votes just aren't there. But we are on the moral high ground, and we have the momentum, and we will not go away unnoticed. We are into the campaign, but the freedom campaign is just beginning. Yeah. It's going to continue, it's going to be very involved, and we're going to do whatever we can to change it. You know, it's almost like we need to take the Republican Party dragging and screaming back to its senses is what we need to do. Elections are losing seats, right and left seats that have been traditionally Republican, and they wonder what's wrong. And then when we come along and say, well, these are our traditions, this is what we believe in, and we are strict constitutionalists, we believe in freedom, and we believe in a strong national faith, I don't know whether we can trust you in the Republican Party, but believe me, we have a lot to offer. We have a lot to offer the country. And we have a lot to offer the party that accepts us. And the Republican Party is the home that I have been in and been a congressman for 10 elections. And that's where so many of us have worked. So we have to use that and do our very best to convince people. And my approach generally over the years has been not with wild expectations that I was going to save the world in a day or two. The question I get asked most frequently in private conversation is, how do you stand it up there? How do you stand it in Washington? Why don't you get totally exasperated, totally frustrated with what happens because of, occasionally I have to vote by myself and a few things like that. I tell them I don't get frustrated. I never get frustrated. I just have low expectations. But my expectations are building lately. But no, I've always seen my role as to run on a platform and tell the people what I believe in and tell them I'm a sincere adherent to the Constitution and then win. And then the next goal was to actually vote that way and then win. So we've been able to do that. And then, of course, the next goal was always to win with growing margins rather than just skipping by and say, see, you're losing. Your positions aren't popular. This Constitution is old-fashioned. We can't deal with that. Well, this year we did have the book thrown at us in our primary. We ended up with 71% of the vote in the primary, and we don't have an opponent in the fall. So setting a standard, and the others will, who lean in our directions, will use a different tactic. They will go to the House floor, and they will, some of the issues they support us, they never seem to support us across the board, but they'll go and they'll try to use the rule book, which is okay, and I don't have any objection to it. It just hasn't been my tactic to try to roll them by, obstructing and technicalities, and I haven't been good at that because I see it as a philosophic problem, changing people's minds and attitudes, changing a generation, changing the whole nature of what the role of government ought to be. And I see this a lot important also in political action of what you do. There's ways to do it, and I think there's every reason, every right, and every obligation that we all have to basically ask for fairness and ask and insist that people follow the rules, whether it's the Constitution or the rules of the party. But the other extreme, that if that is not available, the other is to set the example and not think that any pushing and shoving and shouting will solve the problem. I don't think it'll work as well as building our numbers. And that's where we should be encouraged. Our numbers are growing. The enthusiasm is growing. The people are coming together, and they're starting to understand it. One of the most important things to understand about what has happened to our country is, for some reason, I know it happened, but I don't know why it happened. But for some reason, 100 years ago or so, freedom got chopped into pieces. There were bits and pieces. There's economic freedom and personal liberty. And there shouldn't be any difference. I mean, they're one and the same. It's your right to your life. And yet we have some people who say, well, they're pretty good on trying to defend the marketplace, but I got to tell you what to do with your social life, and we're going to manage your social affairs. And then somebody else says, oh, no, we have to respect civil liberties for the individual to do what he wants on his own. But you're not smart enough about how to spend your money. The whole idea to get this problem solved is to bring people together and say that freedom is a whole. It's one thing. It's the right to your life. Your social life is the right to your economic life. And the magnificent thing that happens when this occurs and people understand this, and it's reflected in our crowds all the time, are the kind of people who join. And some of them don't look like average Republicans. But that shouldn't offend anybody if they're voting for freedom. That's all that counts. But if we come together, we're unified on the very important issue that we agree on our freedom to do as we choose, if we don't hurt other people, we don't steal from other people, don't damage their property, and we come together, and then what you do with your life is not offensive to the other person. And if you don't impose your way on them, we should come together. Now, what we have today is exactly the opposite. They control our money, and they're always telling us how to live. The power's in Washington, D.C., and elsewhere, you know. And everybody has to rush and try to get some of their money back. And then when the pie starts to shrink, production goes down, and then they start inflating and taxing and borrowing to the hilt. Then people become angry because they're afraid they're not going to get their share. And that is what's happening in this country. It's becoming more divisive. They talk about, you know, coming together with change and new ideas and all this stuff. But what are they talking about if they don't mention some specifics? Nothing. If they want change, you got to talk about what kind of change in foreign policy, what kind of change at the Federal Reserve, what kind of change at the IRS, what kind of change at this runaway welfare system and deficit financing. Then you'll know where they stand. And this is what the American people are starting to realize. That real change means something and has to mean something, and this then can bring the people together. And then we aren't in competition with each other. I mean, it's a beautiful, wonderful idea. And yet, it might be slipping away from us. It is slipping away from us. We have a crisis here going on since 9/11, and it was said that, oh, they attack us because we're free and rich. Well, I just wonder if some of them think if we're less free, maybe they won't attack us or something. Because it seems to me that's what they're doing to us. But safety and security depends on freedom, and that is most of our security doesn't come from a policeman standing out in front of our house guarding us. Where there's the most policemen and the most laws against drugs and everything else in the inner city, they have the most crime. Where's the least amount of crime? Where there's the least amount of police, the least amount of laws, and where the most guns are. Yeah, that's where we're safest. Sovereignty. We are very concerned about the loss of sovereign rights of the individual to our states and our states to our federal government. But now there's a systematic attack on the sovereignty of this country. And therefore, I have taken a very strong position. I've introduced legislation every year to deal with this. And that is 1149, which says that we don't need to be, and we ought to get out of the United Nations.
USA! 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 USA!
pro sovereignty audience. And the other accusation that's made is that some of our positions sound like, yes, we love our country, we love the USA, we love our Constitution. Oh, Europe is an isolationist, you don't want to talk to anybody. But, you know, that is not the case. It's really the opposite. I think we're getting isolated from the world. Our policies, we have less friends and more enemies than ever before. What we're talking about, what the founders talked about, was, you know, to be able to trade and travel and talk to people and negotiate with people and have diplomacy with people. It is a position, some who say that because I don't vote for the WTO wants to regulate all our economic lives and our vitamins and all this, that means that I'm not for free trade because I won't vote for NAFTA and CAFTA and all these organizations. At the same time, they're the ones who oppose trade with Cuba, and I say it's time we talk to the Cubans and trade with Cubans and let us go visit with the Cubans. So it is an isolationism. We shouldn't lack confidence. I think it's lack of confidence when we have to throw our weight around and tell people what to do. We don't have self-confidence. You know, it's too often we've been offered two choices in our relationships around the world. We go around the world, we're super wealthy, and we have all this military power, and we go to a country and we say, all right, we want you to do this. And then they object. And then we say, all right, we're going to bomb you. Then we go to another country and they say, we want you to do this. I say, oh, okay, we don't want bomb, we'll do it. Okay, we'll send you money. Why can't we have a third option? Why can't we just go and talk to them and say, would you like to trade with us? Would you like to travel back and forth? Would you like to have exchange students? And do things like that, rather than having this option of either subsidizing or bombing. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. The great message of this year is that there's many more opportunities than I ever dreamed. There are many more of you than I ever knew existed, and the numbers are still not known. If we have, in the conservative estimate, 3 million people now who support the message of liberty and determined to change things and understand the real essence of what we're talking about, I would say that, you know, if this continues at this rate, it's going to grow exponentially. We don't know what will happen because tomorrow, you know, there may be some bombs dropped on the Iranians and the Straits of Hormuz may be closed, which would be an utter disaster. Oil could go and double in price. We don't know how quickly this could come unravel. And so it's very dangerous, which means that there's so much in place for the declaration of national emergency and military law. It's on the books. Believe me, they don't have to come to the Congress. And besides, sometimes they do things without even pretending to come to the Congress. But the laws have been changed. Emergency powers are there. So we do live in dangerous times, and we have to be ready. But it's sort of a racing time. Can our numbers continue to grow? Can we influence enough people to understand this, to respond in the proper manner, either in a deliberate, slower fashion, or if we have a major crisis? And this is the reason that in a group like this is, it's large, it's enthusiastic, but it's relatively small. When you think of the many, many millions who don't really get involved in politics and they vote for superficial reasons. But you as a political activist have much more responsibility than anybody else, especially when you come upon the truth. If you come upon the truth and you know what our traditions are, what our Constitution means, how liberty works and how the market works, and you know all these things, you have a greater obligation to yourself and to your family and to our community and to our country, which means that you have a job to do. And a lot of people will come and tell me what my job is. Don't come to me and ask me what your job is. I can do a little bit. I can tell you about the philosophy, and I can do what I can do. I can run for office, and I can do a few things like this, and do my very best. But your job, it may be just supporting another candidate, supporting this campaign that we've had, supporting the next campaign, running for office, supporting another candidate, further educating, further understanding, because it's a tragedy that we haven't learned to take this wonderful, beautiful message and get the moral high ground. We are accused, and sometimes it sticks unfairly, that we lack compassion. And yet, like I said earlier, the individual that is a true compassionate person has to believe in freedom, because that's what takes care of the maximum number of people. Where you have poverty and starvation and famine is where you have dictatorship and no free markets and no private property. So the obligation is there. You have obligations currently right now. You have obligations tomorrow to present the case the best way you can in the best presentable manner. And then go on to the next stage. And I would like to see, you know, this has been a year and a half plus. I would like to see some real excitement done up in Minneapolis at the National Convention. We might call that a grand finale, to the campaign, but in many ways, if it is to that campaign, it will be the very beginning of a much bigger campaign with more impact for this country. Thanking you very much for coming and your enthusiasm, the support for the campaign, belonging to meetup groups, and all of you who have participated, because it's happening. It's happening around the country. I have been slow in getting to Missouri, but I heard there were a lot of you here, and I am glad I finally got here. We don't know what the future will bring. We don't know what tomorrow will bring, or next week, or next month. But I do know that if we do nothing and we do not present this message, it will not be good for our country, our lives, and it will not be good for our children. There's no reason in the world why we can't win the philosophic fight and then win the political fight. Thank you very much.